Good morning. We'll call a meeting of the House Ag Policy Committee to order. We have a whole bevy of bills on the agenda today, so let's get going with it. And we do have a quorum on hand, so Representative, let's see, Lewick has checked the minutes, and would you approve the minutes for the meeting?
Mr. Chair, so move.
Very good. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes approved. There we go. First up is Chair Hamilton. And Chair, you're going to have a couple of bills, so let's move to your first bill, House File 761.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, could I get somebody to move that bill for me?
Okay. I'll move that House File 761 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Right.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill pertains to AFRAC. That is the Minnesota Agriculture, Fertilizer, Research, and Education Council. And I can give a background on AFRAC if anybody would like additional information. Otherwise, this bill, all it does is simply aligns the expiration dates of the council and the procedures for issuing the grants with the actual account. There will be no fiscal impact, Mr. Chairman. So, again, it just aligns everything. So, if you'd like additional information than that, I'm more than happy to explain. Otherwise, I know you have a very, very full agenda.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, and I think you have a testifier.
I do.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and tell us who you are and proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bond, and I represent the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. And as related to this bill, I am on the board as an alternate of the what we call the AFRAC board. And what I would like to say is that this organization is a very true and very well-working public-private partnership. The actual concept of this was a gentleman that you, a number of you know well, Representative Al Junkie, put this concept together. When we started a number of years ago, actually a very challenging organization to create. There are a lot of differences, but what it ultimately did is bring together a lot of the agribusiness trade associations and the promotional council farmer-led organizations together to look at research related to fertilizers and education related to fertilizers, and it came off a voluntary 40-cent increase in the fertilizer tonnage fee that is collected by the industry from farmers to pay into this fund. And Representative Anderson, you had a little corrective bill for this a couple of years ago that actually created a even stronger organization where the fund has its own fund. It raises over $1 million a year. And the board of directors of this organization is comprised of a lot of the agricultural groups. We have two sitting board members, and they make decisions about how that fund is going to spend its money to do research and education. And there is an impressive list of research that's been done, being done, a large percentage of by the University of Minnesota, but not all. This is truly a agricultural-led organization. And I would also say that this really could be a prototype for other kinds of public-private partnerships that agriculture wants to pursue. But in this case, I commend Representative Hamilton for sponsoring this bill. I think it makes a lot of sense, and we're proud to be a part of it.
Mr. Bond, and just to reaffirm, this bill is funded by farmers who buy fertilizer, correct?
That is correct. It is a 40-cent fee on fertilizer that we supported as an increase from the current fee that is paid.
Very good. Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yesterday we heard this a presentation on this particular item, not this bill, but Representative Hansen yesterday had a question, and I just wanted to clarify. You said it's on farmers, and certainly the bulk of the money comes from farmers, but the fertilizer, it's on all fertilizers. So there could be some that are purchasing fertilizer who live in a metropolitan area but might not be, it might just have gardens or might have lawns or whatever, that are also paying the surcharge. Is that correct?
Mr. Bond.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pompey, the 40-cent fee was levied on fertilizer. The vast majority of it comes from agriculture. Mm-hmm. The purpose of this was agricultural fertilizer research. That was the focus that brought this together and keeps it focused, and it really does work.
And follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but I think I just have a question about, again, as Representative Hansen was talking about water quality, and I'm just thinking, sometimes farmers get a bad rap because they're seen as always can be the problem, and especially if I know this is related to agriculture and related to farming, but I'm wondering if there's any kind of quantifiable documentation that maybe there's something also that might come from city people who are using fertilizer, and if you're able to do any research on that or have done any research that would also kind of maybe talk about that. So, sorry, Tim.
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pompey, that's what I believe is the beauty of this program, because whether we're talking about technology, climate patterns, plant genetics, new crops, or other ag changes as they continue to emerge, the fertilizer recommendations and the associated strategies around all this, as that evolves, it'll help maximize the fertilizer, the efficiencies and profits, regardless of where you're at, regardless. And so it sees no boundary. Whether you're utilizing fertilizer right here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or out in rural areas, it does see no boundaries here. Everybody can benefit, and that's what I believe is the beauty of the program.
Any follow-ups, Representative Pompey?
No.
And just a reminder that this fee is 40 cents a ton. Farmers buy fertilizer by the ton.
Right.
I just did some quick math yesterday during the hearing, and a 40-pound bag of fertilizer picked up at a hardware store, I think the fee is 8/10 of a penny on that. So it's there, but it's very, very minuscule. Question from Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And just to kind of follow up on the tack that Representative Pompey was saying, we were trying to find ways to help urban farmers. And is there a way that they could be helped by this fund or this not just sort of in general research, but if they wanted to do some research in that area, would that be something that could happen?
Representative Hamilton?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Bly, again, when we're talking about this or the whole concept behind those research dollars that we passed that went into the University of Minnesota for productivity ag research, everybody benefits, regardless, whether you're large or small, whether you're urban or rural. Everybody can benefit from that research and from this as well. This is talking about the usage of fertilizer and how it can best be managed for whether we're talking about the environment, whether we're talking about profitability, efficiencies. Again, it sees no boundaries.
Follow-up, Representative Blyle? Okay. Anybody in the audience who would care to testify either for or against this bill? If not, any final comments, Chair Hamilton?
I appreciate your support.
Okay. I'd renew my motion to that House File 761 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thanks, Chair Hamilton. Next bill on the agenda is House File 610. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 610 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, before I get started, can I ask, have you checked with civil law? And I guess I haven't. I wanted to make sure that was the right place to go. They do want to see it. Okay, because we're not really changing trust law so much as we're changing property tax law. I know it's got to eventually go to property taxes, but that's fine. So,
okay, very good. And Representative Knobloch, welcome to the committee, Ag Committee, and please present your bill.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, members. House File 610 helps solve a tax problem for farm families that want to use a common estate tax planning technique. One common estate tax planning technique is to separate your assets, in this case farmland, into two roughly equal in value different revocable trusts in order to take advantage of the tax exemption that exists in the estate tax law. However, in 2012, the Minnesota Department of Revenue declared that different trusts could not be linked for homestead tax purposes. Thus, a married farm couple who wants to set up two different trusts with their home and land split between them can no longer qualify for agriculture homestead status. This bill ensures that married farm couples are not forced to choose between losing the benefit of common estate tax planning techniques and the property tax benefits that come with the ag homestead tax. This somewhat complex bill is supported by the Minnesota State Bar Association, which has been very involved in drafting it. We also have a situation around the state right now, it's my understanding, where different counties are interpreting this differently, so that some counties are granting ag homestead tax classification to people with a marital and family trust where they've got their property in those two different trusts, and some counties are not doing that. So this bill would help clarify that as well. And members, I have Mike Sampson, an attorney who's been very involved with the Minnesota State Bar Association in working on this bill as a testifier, and he'd like to give a few comments too.
Good morning, sir. Tell us your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Michael Sampson. I'm an attorney.
Could you get that mic a little bit closer?
Sure.
Thank you.
I'm an attorney at the Maslin Law Firm in Minneapolis and member of the State Bar Association's Legislative Committee. You might say, why all these trusts? And we use trusts in estate planning for a whole bunch of reasons, one being to allow people to avoid the need for a probate proceeding, which is where these revocable trusts become useful. We want to avoid a probate at each party's death, husband's death if he dies first, and then subsequently his spouse's death. And that's one of the reasons we create a revocable trust for each. If we divide their property between them and we can't link them together, we have to give up the ag homestead status in order to get that benefit. The second reason is we can't tell, at least I can't figure out a way to tell, which spouse is going to die first. And so because of that, we have to split the assets so that the tax result comes out the same either way, if spouse, husband dies first or wife. And by splitting them that way, we lose the ag homestead treatment under this rule. We also use trusts to keep the family farm in the family. And by consolidating ownership in these trusts for kids, for example, who aren't quite yet ready to take over the farm, a trust allows somebody, a trustee, to manage it until they are ready. So these trusts are not just tax planning techniques, but also very valuable to the family farm itself. So the real problem I see here is twofold. One is it's inconsistent tax treatment for people who have a valuable property in the city, a valuable home on Lake Minnetonka, for example. If a husband and wife split the ownership between themselves, they can still get homestead tax treatment for it, even if it's in a trust, because of the way the rules read. But that same value could not be granted ag homestead treatment because the rules don't allow for trust ownership. The second inconsistency that we see is that different counties apply the rules differently. I've spoken with lawyers in outstate counties who say they have clients in different counties that have exactly the same planning situation but get a different tax result. And consistency of treatment across taxpayers seems to be an important policy.
Questions from members? This is a Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. This is not up my wheelhouse. I have trouble understanding this, so I'm going to ask a simple question. When both the husband and wife pass, and so assuming it goes to the children, what happens to the homestead status at that point? Let's say the children live in another state or that sort of thing.
Mr. Sampson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, it's it depends a little bit on how the property is owned after that time and whether it's farmed by a member of the family. But under the rules as they exist today, if a farm is farmed by a member of the family and it's owned in common, then it still would be eligible for homestead, ag homestead classification. But if nobody lives on the farm and none of the people who live on the farm farm it, then it wouldn't qualify for ag homestead treatment.
Representative Johnson.
And thank you. And then follow up on your comment, which stimulated my question, was when the children aren't ready to take over operation of the farm, they may be too young or they may be in another situation where they want to move back, that can take a year or two or three or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in that interim? And explain that, please.
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Johnson, that is a situation where, I think it depends on if they're living in the property and renting it out, for example, for cash rent. There may be ag homestead treatment. But if they're not living in the property, I think that's really the key, is the person who's farming the property or benefiting from the farm property living in it. So I think it would depend on those situations. If the kids were minors and moved into town with an uncle and are not living there, then it's not a homestead. So then it would be taxed as agricultural property.
Thank you.
And Mr. Sampson, that also gets into the area of Minnesota's estate tax, that if a family member farms it for 3 years, they would qualify for the larger $5 million exemption, too. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is also correct. And part of the reason this is relevant to that question is that the estate tax deduction for qualified farm property requires, as a precursor to that benefit, ag homestead treatment of the property in the deceased person's estate. So if it doesn't qualify for ag homestead treatment because it's in a trust, which we created for all kinds of good other planning reasons, then they don't get that extra benefit. And that benefit is intended, I believe, to allow farmers to keep family farms together, even in this era where ag prices are per acre extremely high. These can be quite valuable, but they're still family businesses.
Yeah. Good point. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new and naive, so I'm okay. You can just say, hey, you just don't get it. How, and I'm troubled by this, I'm sure you said it this way, is that the interpretation of the tax code and the application of it could vary county to county?
Mr. Sampson, was that the end of your question?
Yeah, question mark.
Okay. Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Salke, that is also a troubling factor that we heard about at the Bar Association. And the reason is because the statutes aren't entirely clear about the distinction between homestead property and agricultural homestead property. The statutes talk about these two separate types of property. There are several statutes that talk about homestead property in trusts being able to continue to receive homestead tax treatment, but they're not expressly referred to as ag homestead property. And so the issue is, does the Department of Revenue from the state level project to all the counties that they need to apply them the same, or is each county commissioner deciding these things on their own? And in fact, that's what's happening. Separate counties are willing to link property held by trusts or for spouses as one property under the statute and treated as homestead property. Other counties are not. And so whatever the result is, it should be the same if you live in Jackson County or if you live in Cottonwood County.
Representative Salk again.
Yes, you've captured exactly why I was troubled by this. My background is real estate broker, kind of larger scale basis. And although property taxes are circuitous and certainly not simple, the application by an authority that theoretically is a state authority seems to be unable to adequately explain to the enacting authorities the intent and the expectation of how to apply. I find that troubling, and I would hope that that could be sorted out and clarified. My sense is that this bill will have nothing to do with fixing that, or will it? Is that a benefit?
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, yes, that in fact is the purpose of this legislation. It's adding a new subsection E at the end of subparagraph 21, which tells you how complicated this statute is, but simply to say that the owner of property is, if it's a trust, is either the person who set up the trust or their spouse or any combination, as long as the trusts are for the benefit of the husband and the wife or spouses. So that the ambiguity in the statute as it exists today about homestead property and ag homestead property getting inconsistent treatment, depending on how the county commissioner reads the language, will be black and white. If you're married, if it's in a trust, it doesn't matter. You can link them together.
One more follow-up.
I'm sorry. Yeah, one more thing. I was most troubled by the fact that there seemed to be the lack of a line of authority as to making this question. So you think making it black and white clarifies the idea that a county assessor still might step out and say, well, you know, I know that you wrote it better and it looks more black and white, but I still think this over here. Is there a break in that line of authority for the application of a state statute or system?
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, it is impossible, at least in my experience, to make a statute that's perfect. But in attempting to clarify, we spent a lot of hours going around figuring out how to describe all the different possible permutations that we could create between two people and multiple parcels of land that they live on and farm. And we think we've captured all the permutations so that there isn't any ambiguity in the statute. If property is agricultural property and you live in it and there's a trust that was either created by you or your spouse or your predeceased spouse, it's ag homestead property as long as it satisfies the criteria of the statute. So it should eliminate the discretion, the technical term we call it is squishiness in the statute, right? That you could say, well, I don't know which category this fits into, so I'm going to decide it fits into this one. It's objectively measurable rather than subjectively determinable.
Thank Representative Backer.
Chair, how frequent of a problem is this with agricultural land for us to change the law like this? Is this something that's a common occurrence, or this is a once a year thing, or is there an area that's obviously ag area would be more, but is there area, a county or something that we see this issue?
Mr. Sampson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I think it's a probably daily occurrence for lawyers in outstate counties in particular who represent clients who own farmland. As you know, farmland values are high right now, and with the exemption where it is important to couples to be able to capture and take advantage of as much of that exemption as they can. And by the common estate planning techniques used to do that, splitting ownership between spouses and using trusts to capture the benefit of that exemption, essentially we have to choose whether we optimize the estate tax result or we optimize the homestead tax treatment result. There really isn't an efficient way to do both. My clients who live in Minnetonka and have a $3.6 million home on the lake don't have to make this choice. They can still get homestead tax treatment and save their estate tax exemption. Farmers, just in Buffalo can't do that. So that's really the challenge. But it does come up all the time with farmland at, $8,000 an acre.
Okay, thank you.
Vice Chair?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, just to comment on that, this was brought to my attention a couple of years ago that this was a problem. So I think this bill is very timely, and it seems to be written very well, and it addresses a situation that really needed to be looked at and clarified. So thank you for that. Anybody? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question about the last section on 8.4 through 8.10. And I need a clarification of current law. Maybe Mr. Sullivan could help. It talks about on line 8.6 that detached land is located in the same township or city or not farther than four townships or cities or combination thereof from the homestead. And that recalls memory of the Quam bill that we heard in this committee, recently and a discussion we've had. I just want an update on the current status of what defines the, under current law, detached land as being eligible for the homestead. Is it currently just in the same township, or is it currently not further than four townships? And I just need, I need my memory.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I'm not as familiar with property tax law, but my understanding is that the four township or city rule is current law, and so that same standard would be applied here for trust, but I would need to check with a colleague to verify that.
I think that's correct, too. And Ribbon of Quansville, I think, deals with if they've been farming it for 10 years, it would qualify for homestead, and that also mentions this four township distance. But I believe that is current statute, that the four township piece is currently. Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you. Maybe the attorney could. Do you know?
Oh, Mr. Sampson.
Yeah.
Should have called on you in the first place.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's all right. Yes, this is current law. It's partly to bring it here so that all the homestead rules for agricultural homestead are in one place, so we don't have to do windshield wiper law going back and forth in the book.
Thank you.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, anybody in the audience would care to testify for or against the bill? Good morning. Identify yourself and proceed, Mr. May.
Morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County Assessor, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. One of the biggest problems our rural assessors deal with constantly is agricultural homestead. It's not an easy question, and to indicate that it's done differently across the state, it probably is a factor of the complexity of the ag homestead is. Minnesota Department of Revenue does give guidance to all assessors across the state about what qualifies as ag homestead and what does not. I always carry this chart with me to show you that today here's the chart that assessors have to deal with when dealing with agricultural homestead. It's not a straightforward question on any of these issues. And every year we have a handful of bills that try to add more bubbles to this chart, and I think we've run out of room. I don't know what the statutory size is, but this is it, and we can certainly pass it around. The Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers each year prepares a legislative position statement, and our position is to alleviate all this complexity that we have, and one of our suggestions is that we support consolidating agricultural land and buildings, excluding house, garage, and 1 acre, into a single classification rate. Changes to the qualifications for agricultural homestead have added to the complexity of administration of the agricultural homestead classification and confusion on the part of taxpayers. And I would only leave it at that and open it for questions to say this is very, very complex, and every assessor, again, as a chart like this that he has to walk through every time someone asks for an ag homestead. So with that, I'd open it to any questions you might have.
Mr. May, I'll ask the first question. This would clarify kind of a gray area. So would you say that this would help or hurt that confusion situation?
Anything that would reduce the complexity and clarify gray areas, I think, would be helpful.
Okay.
But the ag homestead complexity is something that adding more bubbles to the chart that doesn't necessarily help.
Yeah. Any other questions from members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll ask it in a different way then. Does this add a bubble to the chart, or does this
or
not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say this adds a bubble to the chart somewhere. In order for assessors to be able to approve these trusts. And I would say again that if you're familiar with trusts, and I'm not an attorney, but everyone I ever saw when I was working, they're all different. There's no two the same. They're each drafted to benefit that particular situation. And I'm sure that each assessor has to look at these and interpret them individually, like you would any other kind of legal document.
Follow up?
No.
I would assume those things will be discussed further in tax committee, but in the scope of this committee, I think the intention is there to do a good thing for farmers who are beginning the process of estate planning and trying to do the right thing to help pass on that family farm. No more questions? If not, any closing comments, Representative Knobloch?
Well, it is a complex area and a complex bill, but I think that we want to move forward with this, A, to get rid of the uncertainty that we've heard exists around the state in terms of different counties treating similarly situated properties in different ways, depending on which county you're in. And secondly, I think allowing people who are in one line of business, the farming business, to take advantage of the law that we have regarding revocable trusts and avoiding probate and so forth, allowing them to do this in the same way that people that are in other lines of business can already do. So I'd appreciate your support.
Very good. With that, Representative Poston renews his motion that House File 610 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion passes, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Vice Chair.
Next bill on the agenda is House File 673. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'd like to move House File 673 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Good. Thank you. Representative Anderson moves the House File 673 to be referred to Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Representative Anderson, please present your bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill deals with the extension of the Nielsi, and I'm sure you all are familiar with that. And I have with me the person that kind of runs the organization. And it was kind of different. It was up for a five-year or a three-year extension, and we talked about that. And I think at least those of us in the ag community realize that Nielsi does a really good job with the funds they have. And we thought maybe let's just make them a permanent commission. So that's the reason for the bill. And we could go and just give them the shorter extension if members feel more comfortable. But again, I think those who deal with the ag part feel that they handle a lot of funds and do such a good job with ag education, farm business management, that we could just as well make them a permanent commission. And they do have to come back every couple of years and present before the committees to get additional funding. So it's not as if they're going to be a runaway commission we'd never hear from again. But just the thought was to make them permanent and not have to have them renew every few years. And with me, Mr. Chair, is the leader of the organization, who would give some background on what MLC is and what they do.
It's Dornick? Yes, Mrs. Dornick, if you could share your testifying.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Dornick, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, or MLSE for short. MLSE was started in 1997 to promote and expand agricultural education opportunities across the state of Minnesota. We report to a 17-member legislative board, which does include six legislators, so three from the House and three from the Senate. We are a two-member staff. It's myself and our program assistant, Carrie Schwab, so we're quite a lean staff. We're housed at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus, and they actually serve as our fiscal agent. And as Representative Anderson mentioned, we come every 2 years and report to both the House and Senate Agriculture Committees and on to approve our funding. So just a tiny background. In 1997, there was a few things happening. One, the University of Minnesota was looking at cutting their agricultural education program that licensed teachers, and this was very concerning as they were the only institution in the state that was licensing teachers. At the same time, many agribusiness people were not being able to find enough technically skilled workers in agriculture. And the third was actually a directive from the legislature that wanted to look at starting a urban high school in the metro area. And so these were three kind of priority catalyst areas that led to the creation of MALC in 1997 and really led to the funding being allocated for it. We've maintained our current form and structure over those 20 years and have really been quite stable in our funding and our actions and our initiatives. So we're truly a gathering of ag-ed stakeholders all the way from secondary, post-secondary, and farm business management. Our statute requires a few things, and we do follow this, and this is what we're trying to accomplish. So a few things it required was to establish a grant program, provide recommendations to the legislature and the governor, serve as a liaison to agribusiness and other related agricultural education organizations, identify needs for agricultural education, and be an information source for agriculture teachers, school districts, and other professional agricultural organizations, and really increase the awareness of agricultural education across the state. And so over the past 20 years, we've focused on many key initiatives to fill the statutory requirements. A few things, we did create the Academy for Science and Agriculture. It's AFSA, which is still functioning. Actually, they went from the high school down to the middle school levels, and it's located in Bad Ness Heights. We've coordinated a scholarship and internship program for our students studying at the post-secondary level to become teachers. We've supported the establishment of two more licensing institutions, so the University of Minnesota Crookston and Southwest Minnesota State University Marshall have joined the University of Minnesota Twin Cities in licensing agriculture teachers. We provide resources for ag teachers such as mentoring programs, an online statewide curriculum, and professional development opportunities. We provide visibility and promotion of ag education through many different forms, you know, press, social media, conferences, workshops we put on, meetings. We work with local school districts when they request that they want to start a program. And actually, Chair Becker, I just found out Rosse School Board approved starting an ag ed program next year. So we hope to be able to help assist them get that running. And then we did create that grant program, and that's probably a lot of what local school districts know us for, and we've awarded over $7.5 million to different schools and organizations. Funding's been relatively consistent, and many budget items just carry year to year with our programs. 93% of our budget goes back out the door, so we only spend 7% on operating. And they're going to those local school districts, particularly, that really require really look to having those funds year after year available. MALC's been renewed multiple times since 97. However, appreciate your consideration of this bill to repeal our sunset. Again, we're a very stable organization. We hope to permanently be able to continue to improve agricultural education across the state. Thank you.
Any questions, first of all? Let's see. From members? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, just a comment. I serve on the MALC board and have for the last few years and will continue, and very much appreciate it. It's a very good combination of people who serve on the board. There are legislators, but many times legislators are the fewest people who are there because we have a lot of people from the agriculture education piece or just, we've had attorneys on there, we've had business people and others who bring a perspective that's good for us to consider when we're thinking about ag education. So I think I'm glad that we're considering this, and I'm hopeful that we can actually pass it and that you can continue to exist long into the future.
Does anyone wish to testify? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering, are there any, my question is the concept of a permanent commission. I think if there are permanent commissions, this one qualifies well. We had the testimony yesterday was excellent, by the way. Just superb. But do we know, are there other commissions related to agriculture that are permanent? And are there, and do we have any concept of how many commissions the state of Minnesota has that may be more relevant for government operations? Again, I'm picking on you, Mr. Sullivan, today. I'm sorry about that, but I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I know that the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy recently looked at all of the advisory groups and commissions that report to the legislature and identified those that were no longer active and should be eliminated, or their laws should be repealed. Within the ag area, there are a lot of temporary advisory groups that report back on farm safety or issues that come up in a more episodic manner. As far as groups like MAILC that provide advice and exist continuously, I'd have to look at how many there are within the ag area, but I would guess maybe five or fewer.
Representative Clark. Johnson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I reiterate my comment that if there is a commission that's permanent, this is a permanent situation. Agricultural education is going to last, we hope that continues in perpetuity. It's hard to imagine in Minnesota where that's not important. So thanks for bringing the bill forward.
Any other questions from members? Does anyone wish to testify in the audience on or behalf or against House File 673? Okay. Representative Anderson, do you have any final comments on the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add that I was at a meeting, I think it was this last summer, where ag education teachers got together and farm business management folks. And the comment made was, it's a good time to be in ag education. And I think a lot of it stemmed from the funding that we provided to MAILC to enhance farm business management. And the morale was high, and the feeling going forward was good. So I just say that in reference to the good job that MAILC has done in making sure those funds get to where we intended them to go. And I would again just ask for your support to make them a permanent commission. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 673 be referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion carries. Well, Representative Anderson, you're back on deck. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 686. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 686 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Representative Anderson moves that House File 686 be referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Election. Representative Anderson, please present your bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill goes back a ways, at least 5 years, I guess. We established this authority with the intention of coming up with a dairy research and education facility. And at times, I think it didn't move as quickly as some of us had hoped. But the commission authority has met now and come up with some solid progress. And we want to give them some additional time and make a few changes to that original legislation from 5 years ago. And with me, Mr. Chair, is somebody who's been involved with that. He'd like to give a brief background on why we should make these minor changes and go forward with this dairy promotion authority, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Deering Macbeth, state your name for the record and share us your presentation.
Good morning, Darren Macbeth on behalf of the Dairy Research, Teaching, and Consumer Education Authority, as well as the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. And my thanks to Representative Anderson for bringing this bill forward in the committee's consideration. It's a very straightforward piece of legislation to do essentially two things. It does extend the sunset date of the Dairy Authority that I'll explain a little bit. And then when authors of the now Chapter 32C envisioned the Dairy Authority, they envisioned it as a standalone entity, appointed board of directors, that eventually would become a fiscal agent and fundraise and apply for general obligation bond appropriations, hire employees, and operate and manage a facility. And that's turned out really to be impracticable, in addition to the fact that the University of Minnesota has stepped up and shown interest in housing and operating the proposed facility on the St. Paul campus. And so, given those circumstances and the way the law was written, that in order to avoid a sunset, that the dairy authority would have to acquire a site to build a facility, and now that the university is going to step into those shoes and provide the site, that's the other reason for this legislation. So just to take a quick step back, in 2011 and then ultimately passed in 2012, original authors of the Dairy Authority legislation were also Representative Anderson, Representative Torkelson, Eakin, Sudzinski, Erdahl, Szymanski, and Ward. And the vision was for, through this appointed board, to evaluate whether it was feasible and where to site and house a public-private partnered dairy research facility, to bring forward insights and production practices and animal housing and feed and nutrition insights, as well as working with, in an academic setting, trainers and professors and teachers and the student dairy program, to really be part of the bedrock of the future of the dairy industry. And it was, in fact, determined that that was feasible and a good idea. And it took some time, as Representative Anderson alluded to really do some soul searching on where it was feasible to site such a dairy. And again, the vision initially was probably in greater Minnesota. And for reasons I won't go into, it evolved into the proposal as it is in front of us now to house it on the St. Paul campus, where there are 120 milking cows now that will essentially be doubled in a new state-of-the-art facility with robotic milking systems and so forth is the vision. So that brings us here to today. The efforts to fundraise and to study the feasibility and to eventually build that facility are ongoing. And so just an extension in the authorities, the dairy authorities authorization is the point of the bill. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Every time I go to the state fair, I see this line of cows at the state at the U. Every time I go over to a couple of the sites over there for meetings, and what have they been doing on dairy farming for the last 200 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, and committee members, you're correct that there are animals on campus, and they're in a somewhat dilapidated old facility. And with
looks like my uncle's farm.
With versus the state-of-the-art facility that has observation areas, including for the public, has lecture and classroom facilities for students and other learning opportunities, and robotic milking systems, which are coming into the dairy industry very strongly, that really fit on a small scale and a large scale, dealing with consistency in production and milking and labor practices. And so there are many, many, many other instances of why an investment in a more modern dairy facility makes sense. And I can't speak to the research or lack of research that's maybe coming out of the existing facility, but I know it's physically quite dilapidated, and to say it plainly, it's not very exciting for students entertaining the dairy program to be coupled with that facility versus what energy a new facility like what we're talking about would bring.
Representative Mahoney.
So then this would go as a bonding project for the University of Minnesota then?
Mr. Macbeth.
That's correct, coupled with private dollars on a one-to-one ratio.
Yes, I'll go for the bonding. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Representative Anderson?
I would add, Mr. Chair, that the private portion of this project is about $50 million, so it's a big ask on the part of private industry as well to support this, and I think that shows their willingness to step up on this and what they see is a real need for the state. And just a quick comment on the what's already at the university and what this could do. To be honest, I was in favor of locating it outstate and when this first came along, but having it at the university in St. Paul campus, where we're close to research, the ag students are right there, and it seems to me that's a logical place to put it and really emphasize the research and educational part of this. Even talk of, you know, it's close to the state fair, so there could be some way to get families to go from the birthing center over to the St. Paul campus and view this modern dairy facility, is we really need to get consumers educated on where their food comes from, how it's produced, and done in a very safe and efficient manner. So I really see the need for a facility such as this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Sock?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In designing the facility, we're going to be looking at future both for learning and for research purposes in terms of operation and systems and that sort of thing. And I was curious, is it going to be constructed in a way, and it may be a self-evident question, but is it constructed in a way and or contemplated that it would support different scales of operation? So, like, there would be ongoing learning and facility research done on the idea of small-scale dairy application of new systems as well as very large scale. My fear is that a big facility goes large scale and everybody that's going through here learns how to function in a 200 plus herd kind of situation. You get the point of my question, so I'm just curious how it's constructed to accommodate that.
Mr. Mabeth?
Committee members, great question, and there was a lot of discussion about the size and scale and scope of this envisioned dairy, especially when they're looking at a greenfield site in greater Minnesota, and sky was the limit on what they could put together. And there were advocates for a large-scale, 1,000-animal-unit style commercial dairy, but it ended up on this 300-cow scale on the St. Paul campus for different reasons, both the size and scale of it and the location. But also, in response to your question, the feasibility and pre-design that we've been through with an engineering team actually includes a tie stall facility as well as the robotic facility, which is very interesting and a little costly to do both. But, where else except in a research setting can you do that? And it's also going to be built in a modular way so that we can't anticipate future technologies, however many years into the future, but with the robotic, the animal housing sites and other sites of the dairy, it's going to be built to accommodate or to change around future options. Good question.
Any follow-up there, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bly?
Thank you, Chair. And appreciate Representative Salk's question, and this is an area that I'm concerned with too and have talked about. I think this is important, and I like the fact that it's at the university. I think it is an important facility. I guess I'm a little concerned when yes, the private sector should be involved, and I guess I'm concerned though about the potential for their driving the research and perhaps pushing us in a direction that ties us into a certain kind of agriculture has caused us some concerns and isn't necessarily where we may want to go in the future. I guess I want to make sure that there's room for change or room for transformation as we can go forward. And I wouldn't want that to, what protections are there so that that doesn't become the norm, that the industry, in a sense, drives the research and pushes it in a certain direction, which may not be good for water quality or may not be good for something else. And we want to make sure that other voices can enter into this.
Mr. Mabeth?
Mr. Chair, I would answer that by directing those concerns to anything the University of Minnesota is conducting in terms of where there's some private funding or a private partner. This would be no different in terms of, yes, there would be private dollars involved to construct it. It's TBD on the future of the research needs and the capital or the investments they need to do the research, to what degree private dollars would flow in to assist that. But yes, for the construction of it, and under the policies of the University of Minnesota's, you know, forthcoming bonding requests, to meet a certain percentage with private dollars to match the public dollars. There are private dollars at stake, but, you know, and it's also TBD in terms of some of the branding or recognition that private contributors would get within the facility and its research. But, you know, back to you know, your concerns about influence of industry, it wouldn't, you know, wouldn't be any different than anything the university is doing with any of its research, in my opinion.
I would just say it doesn't give me great comfort, and I guess I would still have concerns and would hope that there's a way that some assurance that we've gone down this path, I guess, where we want the university to go after private funding for various things, and I don't think it necessarily serves the state in the best way. So I just register concerns.
Representative Paul Anderson?
Just a comment. And Representative Bly, I understand your feelings on some of these you know, large, tight facilities. But I would say, however you feel about, you know, larger facilities, I've toured a few of them, and the big ones, because they have people on staff that can monitor water quality, for example, they do it right. They'll have a settling pond for rainwater when it runs off their driveways and such. So if you're kind of, in a way, talking about the size of this at the university, it will be done right in terms of, you mentioned water quality and things like that. So I don't share that concern. And I would just say that I have a high degree of confidence that it will be done right, conform to all regulations, and they'll do a good job there.
Yep, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I agree with you. I think the facility will be designed in a way that will meet those things. What I'm thinking about or concerned about is the research that might be done or what kind of influence might come from private industry to influence the research. I agree with you. I think that having at the university will make assurances that it is set up in the right way and they can do that construct something that will be working and looking for the best interests of the state.
Does anyone wish to, in the audience, testify for or against House File 686? Okay, seeing none, Representative Anderson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
Mr. Chair, no, we've pretty well talked it over. I would just renew my motion that House File 686 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 686 be referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The next bill on the agenda is House File 199. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Well, I'd like to, but I don't know if it's ready yet, Mr. Chair. This bill has attracted a lot of attention, and I think it needs more work. So I'm just going to put this bill before the committee, and I think we will wind up laying it over, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Anderson moves House File 199 to be put in front before the committee. Is there an amendment? Representative Anderson, would you like to move the H-0199-A1 amendment at this time?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. The A1 amendment relates to who actually have to be the person that informs people or authorities when they've found these eradicate weeds. And talking with the extension people, they're the ones that would, in a lot of cases, identify these super weeds, but they didn't feel that they were the ones that should be getting the word out. They thought that should go back to the Department of Ag, so I agreed to have an amendment to take the extension people out of the enforcement or enforcing folks. So that's what that amendment does, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're also then have Representative Anderson move the 8-0199-A3 amendment, because that's an amendment to the amendment. Is there any discussion? Oh, Representative Anderson, do you want to speak on that amendment?
The A3? That's a separate amendment.
I thought that was the... it's an amendment to amendment, so it does modify, Representative Anderson, A3 does modify A1. So at this time, we would move A3 amendment.
Okay, and again, it's getting at who would be the actual inspectors and have to inform the neighboring property owners. It was brought to my attention that the way it was worded previously, it would also bring into the equation cities. And again, I don't think cities, at least we hope, won't have an invasion of Palmer amaranth, so they asked if they could be taken out of the equation as well. And then we got it into county folks, the weed inspectors, and they didn't all have weed inspectors. They have a county designated employee, town board supervisor, and such. So that's the reason for this amendment to the amendment, Mr. Chair, and I would ask for its passage as well.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Right now we're on the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion? Representative Bly?
Yes, thank you, Chair. And thank you for your last comments, Representative Anderson. I guess I was wondering if there are counties that either don't have someone to perform that purpose, is it going to be an additional cost to the counties? Is there some money that should be allocated for helping them? I mean, one of the things I found in my counties is they say they really throw up their hands and say, we can't deal with these weeds because we don't have the funds to do it. I guess I just asked that question.
Representative Anderson?
That's a very good point, and one of the reasons for holding this bill over, we're going to have to get some additional funding for this. No intention to put another mandate on the counties, but it looks like they're going to be the ones that are going to take on the yeoman's role here in enforcing and getting the word out to landowners. That was not my intention, but if this bill goes forward, we'll have to get some funding to not make this an unfunded mandate.
Thank you.
Representative Sock, to the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's coming to my mind here is that there is a difference between mandatory reporting and dealing with the problem, being the agency by which the solution has to be delivered or that sort of thing. There's other parts of my life where I've been around and had the responsibilities of mandatory reporting, and maybe this is part of the discussion that has to be had. But the benefit of mandatory reporting is so that an issue, by anybody's enlightenment, goes to and becomes reported to an agency for action. You're really not going to say that because somebody stumbled across the knowledge of something existing, they have to solve it. But you are saying that because of the nature of this item, whatever it would be that it requires a reporting, we want it to become known so that others can be aware of its existence in their proximity, and so that the appropriate agency who has the systems and or ability to work on the problem gets notified and brings their systems to bear. So I think it would be useful here that if some people that are maybe struck with fear be, and maybe they get accommodated by wording, so that it's just the reporting that's the mandatory, because we want that knowledge to be public and available, and it's not that we're trying to make them be responsible for solving it. So, and maybe that's more of a comment, but maybe you also have knowledge of the way you're working toward getting this done. By the way, I really think this is an important and good thing. So I would like it to be as useful as possible and practicable.
Okay. Representative Anderson, did you want to comment on that?
I sure do. I couldn't have said that any better, Representative. And that was the intent going ahead with this to make sure, I mean, this is such an explosive weed situation, to make sure the adjoining property owners were aware that the weed was in the area, and for them to be on the lookout to, in case it had already moved to their property. It wasn't that easy to try to get something that will work and folks feel comfortable with, and then again doesn't put a mandate on the counties. I envisioned the Department of Ag to be the ones that would inform the adjoining landowners about it. Then it was also brought up this morning that that may entail the feeling of you're telling on somebody, and the person who has the weed is a bad person because they let this weed come onto their land. Well, that's not the case, but we want to try to work with folks so that we can get this done, and it does accomplish what we intended it to, and that is to keep this weed from spreading and to fully eradicate it in the state of Minnesota.
Follow-up, Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The point being, if we put it in the right kind of context, I think it alleviates most of the fear. When we dealt with meth in terms of houses and that sort of thing, we didn't immediately think the landlord was a bad person because meth was discovered. But we knew real well that that was an immediate public health hazard and that it needed a specialized group of 10 people to come and have attention. So I'm bringing a completely different scenario, but I think this is a similar kind of thing where there's a separation of public knowledge and basic warning versus this issue of fault and the and then separate also the body that has to bring the solution to bear. And if you get them separated, maybe by wording or whatever, that then it alleviates that fear factor a little bit, allowing them to be more innocent about saying, hey, I found this in my property.
Yeah. Okay. We have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for working on this bill. I agree with you, Representative Anderson. This is a step in the effort to eradicate. But I see there's a, you reference in the amendment to the amendment, a town board supervisor or town assistant weed inspector. And have you had a chance to talk with the townships and see how they, you know, or are they here to testify? I'm curious how they would respond to that specific language.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Representative Anderson.
Again, a good point, and the counties are supposed to have a weed inspector, but again, we provided no funding to them, so we have to look at that again. And yeah, town board, I was a little surprised at that myself, but it was put in there that that they would be also the inspector or the enforcer. And again, we're going to have to work on that. We're going to meet with the counties tonight. I'm sure we'll hear about it. But have not heard from the townships, to answer your question.
Representative Johnson, no follow-up? Okay. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Representative Johnson stole my first question because it's pretty widespread there, and I don't know if you want me to ask the question on the A1 at the same time, but my worry with the you're trying to have the Department of Ag do all the notifications. So stop and think about this. You walk out of your land, you see the weed, or someone sees the weed, yeah. They notify the county. That's an email, that's a day. And then they get out to the Department of Ag. And I don't know about the Department of Ag, but I get 200, 300, 400 emails in a day. I don't necessarily get through all of them in a day, especially when it's like Bob Smith is a subject line. So my worry with this is the time lag and how you're notifying people. And does it take a week to notify the landowner next door? Or what? And I don't think you've addressed that in here, and you might want to think about that. I mean, it sounds like you're going to be working on this bill.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. Is this weed an issue if it takes a week or 2 weeks to get notification to you know, the farmer next door or in the other farmers in the county, and because I know if I don't start dealing with that mint that's trying to grow wherever it wants to grow in my garden, I bet if I wait a week, it's a lost battle that year.
Yeah.
And I've got a pretty good garden, and I, you know, I try to take care of it. And then, you know, my only, on the A1 amendment, you have an employee of the University of Minnesota Extension confirms the presence. Do they have the capacity to do that? I mean, do they have the number of FTEs in order to go through that in the lab process or whatever it is that verifies that we, because we as a state continue to ask our state employees to do more and more and more with less. This seems, and I'm just a new kid on the block around here. I've never seen this much angst about a weed, but I understand it's an important one now. Are you getting them enough people at the university to take care of this if you're going to put this particular responsibility on them? Something to think about. You're working on the bill.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good points raised. And I would think, talking about the lag in reporting, this is a fairly new weed, and it looks like other weeds. It looks like water hemp, I think, to the untrained eye. So if I were to go out in my field and think that I found this weed, I'd want to call somebody in who was more of an expert than I would be in weed identification, which would be the county inspector or somebody from Extension. And Extension, I think, has offices throughout the state and are within fairly close distances to where they would be called. And I would hope that the biggest thing would have to be identified positively right off the bat. And you have to have somebody who is knowledgeable in making that identification, and then getting word down to the Department of Agriculture and getting word back out again. And as to if there are enough staff to do that, I think there's also a fiscal note here someplace with this bill, and we have to deal with it. And hopefully this is not going to be a rampant problem. It's been just in two counties so far, and if we can keep a handle on it, I would hope it wouldn't get to be a widespread big problem. And if it's in just that area, to really concentrate and eradicate it from that area.
A follow-up, Representative Mahoney.
That's kind of exactly what they said about Emerald Ash Borer about 10 years ago.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's really just a statement that I understand what you're trying to do here, because the Department of Agriculture has said that we have zero tolerance for this weed in the state, and we have to address what zero tolerance means. We've either heard in this committee or other ag committee what it takes to you have to burn it with a torch when it shows up. I mean, it's pretty dramatic, especially if you understand the size of some of these fields. You don't see one weed. If you're going to see one, I think they spit out several thousand seeds if they come to full seeding. And so I appreciate the fact that there needs to be some work on this, but we got to figure out a way to be able to report this and report it quick, because I do think we're going to see it's pretty prevalent in Iowa, I'm told. Correct? And I think we're going to need to address this in Minnesota. So I encourage you to keep working on it on behalf of the health in any way that I can.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Any comments on that, Representative Anderson?
No, I agree.
Okay, all in favor in the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now we're back to the, got to keep those formalities. We are back to the A1 amendment as amended. Is there any discussion on the A1? All in favor of the A1 as amended, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment is as amended and is adopted. Okay, Representative, now we have the bill back to the intent that the author wants it.
testifiers, or did you want to speak before the I have two testifiers. Do you want to add anything more before the testifiers?
No, let's hear the testifiers.
Okay, the first one I have is J.D. Burton from the University of Minnesota. When you come up, please state your name for the records and provide us your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is J.D. Burton. I am with Government Relations with the University of Minnesota. I first wanted to say thank you to the committee and thank you to Chair Anderson for bringing this issue forward. He has been very amenable in hearing some of the concerns that we have raised and continuing to make progress, particularly with the amendment that was offered today. So I want to thank you for that and the willingness to continue to keep talking about it. We share the concern very strongly that the university wants to be a part of solving these issues and on reporting and addressing this. The concern that we have raised with the chair is that Extension is not a regulatory agency, it's an education agency. And we are concerned that there may be some unintended consequences where landowners or others who identify this on their property will normally come to the University of Minnesota for the education purpose to understand it, may not feel comfortable in doing that, knowing that the university, through Extension, it would be required to then report it to the department. We don't think this will occur very often, but it is a concern, and it does take Extension out of its realm that it has historically been, which is an education institution. So we have raised that with the chair. He's been very amenable to taking a look at that, and we are looking forward to finding some language that will work to accomplish this goal.
Any questions from members for Mr. Burton? Representative Sock?
I would only ask, at what place along your interpretation of responsibility do you think that you should continue to avoid what would all the benefits of public notice? Because I get your point. And one of the things in my life that has come up on in terms of the issue of mandatory reporting is that it's people saying, gee, I don't know that I want to be the one that end up blocking the benefit to the public and to the neighbor and to the affected people. I've always wondered, so what affected person should think it's okay for you to harbor or theoretically create this safe zone for somebody who is impacted by it?
Mr. Burton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, I don't think the perspective that we have is to harbor any type of information. We want to remain a resource so that landowners and others can feel comfortable coming to us to ask questions. I think the concern that we have is that that may not occur if there's a concern that we have to mandatorily. We do want to be a part of that process, and that's why I'm very encouraged with the reception of the chair to find that solution now.
Any other questions, members, for Mr. Burton? Nope, none. Okay. Very good. Then our next testifier is Mr. Tim Powers from the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. Please state your name and share us your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tim Power. I'm representing the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I would like to read the testimony that was presented to the Senate committee last week as presented by Dr. Jim Calkins, who is our current regulatory manager at MNLA. Good afternoon, Chair Weber and committee members, and of course this was presented to the Senate. My name is James Calkins, and I am here today as a member and on behalf of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, MNLA, which represents nearly 2,000 nursery growers, garden centers, and landscape service providers, and a multitude of allied industry partners and suppliers across the state of Minnesota. I am also privileged to represent the MNLA as a member of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Noxious Weed Advisory Committee. Noxious weeds are a serious threat to agriculture, including our membership and the public they serve, and to native ecosystems in Minnesota. And while it may be for the unfortunate reason that Palmer amaranth was recently found in the state, we appreciate the attention that noxious weeds and the need for funding to support noxious weeds management are receiving from the legislature this year. And we support and encourage such efforts now and in the future. While we recognize the good intentions behind Senate File 405 and House File 199, and the proposed changes this legislation would make to the Minnesota Noxious Weed Law. We are concerned that the proposed changes to the Noxious Weed Law would have a negative impact on the reporting of noxious weeds and ultimately the management of noxious weeds and invasive species in Minnesota. Given how the Noxious Weed Law is already being successfully implemented today, and that the proposed legislation could very likely discourage landowners from coming forward to report noxious weeds, and especially the prohibited noxious weeds, in response to fears of retribution from their neighbors, we are concerned that, that the proposed legislation could weaken rather than strengthen the Noxious Weed Law. In general, we believe the Noxious Weed Law already works well in this regard, and that the MDA and county weed inspectors have a good track record of working with landowners to manage noxious weeds, and the effectiveness of these programs has been evidenced by the quick response to the discovery of Palmer amaranth in western Minnesota. The goal should be to protect landowners from retribution and to promote voluntary reporting if prohibited noxious weeds are found, which is exactly what happened with Palmer amaranth. We are also concerned that there may be conflicts with federal laws regarding data privacy related to federal cooperative agriculture programs like the USDA's Conservation Reserve Program, which benefits farmers and the environment by reducing soil erosion, improving water quality and groundwater recharge, increasing wildlife habitat, including habitat for pollinators, and reducing flooding damage. This isn't to say that the Minnesota Noxious Weed Law couldn't be improved. For example, we could do a better job of preventing the spread of noxious weeds to new areas. This requires reliable and dedicated funding, which has historically been limited. We encourage the legislature to support noxious weed management and ask that legislators remain engaged with this issue and work together with the MDA to determine how the Noxious Weed Law might be improved, with the goal of achieving better outcomes related to the management of noxious weeds in Minnesota. We hope our concerns can be addressed should this bill move forward. Thank you, and I thank you for your interest and time today. And, Mr. Chair, I might add that I preceded Dr. Calkins representing MNLA on the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee, and I would be happy to answer any questions from members if they occur.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, Mr. Powers. Is there any questions from representatives for our members for Kim Power or Mr. Burton or Representative Anderson? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know that I have a question directed to you, but Representative Anderson, I can see what you mean about this is fraught with some issues, and we need to address that. And I think I might be on this bill, and I think that it's important for us. You know, we do have noxious weeds. You know, we've heard about noxious weeds for a number of years. It's just that as they come up and all of a sudden they're an economic issue for some people, they're definitely more concerned about it than when it's just a noxious weed that happens to be prevalent somewhere. So I think we definitely want to be addressing it, but I appreciate your testimony. I think that was helpful just to, you know, we don't necessarily have to go at it from a different angle if the angle just needs to be better funded, that we're currently going after it, or we need to do some minor things in order to improve what we're already doing. So thanks for the testimony, and Representative Anderson, I appreciate that there's work to be done, and we're not yet ready to move with this one. Thank you.
Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I would just like to comment on the way Palmer amaranth arrived on the noxious weed list. The Commissioner of Agriculture has control over the designation or de-designation of terrestrial noxious weeds, whereas DNR has the authority over the designation of aquatic invasive species. The typical process lasts 3 or 4 years before a weed will be designated. Once Palmer Amaranth was close, and it became a worry for the state of Minnesota. The Department of Agriculture moved very quickly. The commissioner used his emergency authority to designate Palmer Amaranth as a prohibited noxious weed on the eradicate list in less than a year after discussion at the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee. I think this indicates how seriously the Department of Agriculture takes their concern about Palmer Amaranth. And as to Representative Mahoney's question about how worried are they, and with 200 emails a day, could they recognize a problem, I would say that this is at the very top of MDA's list of concerns today, at least in the division of plant protection. And I think that MDA is fully prepared to deal with this issue. We would strongly support funding to support this effort.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Representative Poppy?
Just one more comment, and that just goes to show again that our Minnesota Department of Ag is one of the finest in the nation. So thank you for that, those comments.
Any other questions from members? Does anyone wish to testify for or against House File 199 as amended from the audience? Okay. Representative Anderson, do you have any final comments on your bill?
I didn't hear yet.
What's that? Do you have any final, I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, do you have any final comments on the bill?
I wish I'd never heard of Palmer Amaranth.
You say that well, thank you.
No, just final comment. This was brought to me by somebody that thought, gee, if the weed is in the area property owners should be made aware of it. And I thought it was going to be a relatively simple thing to do, but I'm finding out that it's not. And we'll keep working on this and try to come up with something that works and try to get some funding, if nothing else, to strengthen what we have, because our counties certainly need more money to work in this area. So, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that we'll just lay this bill over.
Okay. House File 199, as amended, is laid over. Representative Lean, the next bill is your bill on the agenda, is House File 200. Also, while we're waiting for Representative Lean, I'd like to recognize, if everybody noticed, we have some people in the audience with maroon shirts on. So they are from, some of them are from the district that I represent, but Red River Valley Emerging Leaders Program, if you feel like stopping them and saying hi. It is a very good program. It goes up and down the Red River Valley, which Browns Valley starts the Red River, so I'm very familiar with how that river is interesting. So but that starts them, and we like, thank you for coming down today and paying taking a visit with us, and appreciate it, and all that you guys do for your area. Representative Bly, would you like to move Representative Green's bill?
I would, Chair. I move the House File 200 be re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division.
Okay. Representative Bly moves the House File 200 be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. Representative Lean, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and that's the North Flowing Red River, if I'm correct, Mr. Chair.
So yeah, we started it.
The South End, yes.
You are correct, Representative.
Yes.
We sent our waters to you.
And us to Winnipeg.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your time and attention on this bill. House File 200 is a bill I put together after meeting with several Clay County farmers over the last 3 years or so. And it's a legislative response to the current situation in the ag economy. For about the last 5 years or so, the ag economy has been slumping with low crop prices. Despite these low crop prices, many farmers are struggling with property taxes as property values remain high. House File 200 would establish a study to look at moving from Minnesota's current market-based assessment system for ag land to an assessment system based on productivity of ag land. The study would be conducted by the Departments of Agriculture and Revenue in consultation with groups representing ag property owners, assessors, and the University of Minnesota College of Food, Ag, and Natural Resources Sciences. The bill directs the study to look at 11 different areas related to ag property taxes that have been identified by landowners, representative ag groups, and the U of M College of Food, Ag, and Natural Resources, such as availability and accuracy of data on ag land, potential shifts onto other properties and other classes of property, valuation volatility under a production-based system, assessment appeals by landowners, and how a production-based system would interact with existing ag property tax programs. The bill appropriates $100,000 for the study and directs the study to be completed by February 1st of 2019 with a report due to the House and Senate Tax Committees. To my knowledge, the last time a study was done on this matter was 1991, and I feel an updated study is required to analyze how best we could move to a production-based value system and what its efficacy would be to Minnesota farmers and the Minnesota ag economy. And, Mr. Chair, I'd also like to add that I had reached out to some Clay County farmers on this issue to come down here today. Unfortunately, they were not able to make the drive today, but they are very committed to this issue and are sorry they can't be here in person to tell their stories. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll open it up to questions, or I believe the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union also have some comments.
Okay, we do have some testifiers. I would like to take those. All members, we will be done at 12 because we do have session at 12:15 today. So our first testifier is Mr. Tom Peterson from the Minnesota Farm Union.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we do support House File 200. This idea has been around actually for a couple of years. This has always been in our policy since I've been with Farmers Union is to address productivity. I think a lot of you are familiar how property taxes work, and I really appreciate the support the legislature has given the last year to addressing the school capital improvement levies, and we're hopeful that passes in the tax bill. But that really only addresses a small part of the problem, as Representative Lean said. Rising property taxes, I forget the number, but it's, you know, it's 100% in the last 10 years or more for many farmers that taxes have gone up. And that follows commodity prices. I think you're all familiar with that. But really how it works, you know, commodity prices go up, land values go up, property taxes go up, prices go down, and land values go down, taxes go down very slowly. And so right now we're in a system where we have high prices or high land values, low prices, and very high taxes. And so it's very difficult to pay that bill. And we always, the farmers always feel like that system is really slow to react to it. And so that's where this idea of looking at productivity would be helpful. Study groups, you know, I'm always the guy that ends up on them for our association, so I'm not always really fired up about them, but I think this is really an interesting one. We did a deal, there's not a lot of new legislators here, but we had a thing with Green Acres many years ago, which is also a property tax. And if we, you know, this is a big ship to turn, you know, looking at this. And so doing a study group on this, I think, is helpful and a good idea. We have had, you know, looked at this issue a little bit. We had a property tax working group in the late 2000s, I think, that I was on that looked at this and looked at our classification systems. You heard on the earlier bill this year, you know, Minnesota, I always say we have 54 different classifications for ag land, where the next nearest state has 14. And so we looked at how taxes are looked at, and that's a really good report if you haven't read that for some of the newer legislators. And then after that, we had kind of an ad hoc working group. It wasn't a where we kind of got together. I think we met two or three times, and this would have been maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And I think at that time we just determined that this is a big thing to get our hands around. We had Steve Taff, who some of you might know from the University of Minnesota, who kind of does a lot with land values. And so that's some of the history of this. And we do, you know, so in closing, we just encourage you to consider this legislation. We think it would be a good value to look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next on deck is Mr. Rupik. Is that close?
Close enough.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for the grace. He's from Farm Bureau Federation of Minnesota. Go ahead, please.
All right. Thank you, Chair. I'm Cole Ruprecht with Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, and like Tom and the Farmers Union, we are in support of House File 200. First off, I would like to thank Representative Lean for his work and involvement on the ag property tax issue, especially with the Clay County Farm Bureau members. Minnesota Farm Bureau supports House File 200 and the continued forward focus on Minnesota's complex property tax system without shifting that burden onto other classes of property tax. And as previously said, we all know right now with high land values and low commodity prices, it's making it difficult for those high property taxes on agricultural land and the burden it places on farmers across the state. With that, I thank you all for the continued support and work that is done on Minnesota property taxes, especially relating to agriculture.
Okay, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, on behalf of a very agricultural district, I want to thank you for this work. I think that any time that we need to continue to have a lot of discussions addressing the many challenges that we have on property taxes and ag, we're doing that with the school levies. We're doing it here. So in our committee, I think we have real good, strong support on this. And my only encouragement as you travel on when you get into property taxes, that's where I think we're going to have some challenges to how this, because the value of what you're producing can change a little bit more quickly, what does that do? And when you talk about having an impact on other people's property taxes, those are some of the concerns. So I fully support what you're doing. I know what you're trying to do, and I give you, any way that I can help is great, but I do think we're going to have some challenges ahead to try and figure out how this works. So maybe that's why you're just doing the pilot part of the study. If you'd like to comment on that.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Miller. And, that was one of my biggest concerns, too, is what is this going to mean for other property classes and types. So that's why I think it's good to do a study rather than just jumping right into something. I mean, I know other members would like to take a look at simplifying the property taxes overall, getting those classifications from the 54, 60, whatever it is, down to a handful. So I think this is a good start, as you say, also, to take a look and do a study on this.
Okay, very good. Other questions from members? Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lewin, for bringing this forward. One of the things I didn't see, and maybe I just missed it here in the list of things that we need to look at in that study, and that would be the base cost to the local units of government, frankly the assessor's got enough to do right now, and that needs to be fleshed out if you're talking about significantly shifting the way we value that land, as to just a consideration that is going to definitely have a fiscal impact on local units of government. The other thing, and again, this is really more directed toward Representative Farm Bureau and Farmers Union. I'll just say this as a word of caution when you head over to the tax committee with this, and Representative Lean, I've got a little bit of concern here that we're going to move this thing in agriculture over to just make it really simple. We're just going to shift ag property and start calling it commercial property, and we'll just determine the value in that method, which is a completely different world. And so just we want to make sure that we understand that understand how that system works when we fix a value for tax purposes, commercial value. It is definitely different than how we deal with ag land. And so there'll be probably some push and shove as to, well, let's just make it simple. Let's just call this commercial property. And I would certainly be one that would not jump into that basket. So just some things to look out for. That one, the cost that will generate the local unit of government to make a substantial change. And then the other one is moving closer to simply commercial appraisal process for commercial property. I'm not sure that would serve our agriculture industry in the long run very well, but it just a little caution.
Reverend
Representative Lee, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to address your comments quickly, Representative Lewick, the assessors would be at the table in the conversation on this study, so they would have their input. Also, taking a look at the way other states do this, because I believe there are 33 states that have some sort of
South Dakota, North Dakota,
they have some sort of income or production base into this. And a lot of that, it's not so much changing the class or the property class type. It's more so looking at soil types, looking at yields, looking at acreage. I know North Dakota has kind of a hybrid mix, so, but I do appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Lewick. The one thing we want to keep on the ag land is that 0.5 rate on the first $2 million. We want to keep that for sure. I think one of the testifiers mentioned that we should make the shift to lower ag taxes, but without shifting the burden to other taxpayers. Well, that can't happen. I mean, they have to raise a certain amount of money, and if you lower one, somebody else has to pick up the difference. So we realize that right now ag land is taxed too high, no doubt about it. But and I would support doing something, but I think we need to move on this carefully. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to speak on, against or for the motion? You'll have to do it quickly there, Mr. May.
I'll do it very quickly.
We have 3 minutes.
Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, Mr. Chair. I would just say this, that we, of course, don't oppose any kind of study that is its goal is to improve the property tax system in Minnesota. So we'd gladly participate if there was a study. With that said, when we deal with agricultural issues, of course, I'm not an agricultural expert, so we rely on our Ag Committee and MAO. And we've sent this bill to them. They've looked at it. They have some reservations about the complexities that it would entail. And so forth, and I've forwarded that to Representative Lee. The other thing I would say is that our county assessor from Macon County had forwarded us an article that is just written, and the state of Nebraska is now wrestling with this very issue, and it's very informative to read that article, and you might want to take a look at that, because a lot of their analysis shows that it's not going to make a large difference, at least in Nebraska. Now, I'm not saying Nebraska is the same as Minnesota, but it's something to look at. So I've also forwarded that to Representative Lee to take a look at. So our Ag Committee does have concerns with the process. We have done it before. It's not a new thing in Minnesota. The Department of Revenue has worked with the University of Minnesota and their ag economists on this type of thing in the past, and I don't want to date myself. I'm not sure how long ago that was. But we had a system called crop equivalency ratings that they were working on, which is very similar to what we're talking about. So just so you know, that's not a new issue, and there's other states that are dealing with that. So
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. On behalf of Representative Bly, Representative Bly renews his motion for House File 200 to be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. And we are adjourned. Thank you, members.